Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by LSJ Media, offering digital marketing solutions to area businesses of all sizes, such as website development, email marketing, optimization, and more. Information at lsjmedia.com.
Welcome to Current State on WKAR. I'm Scott Pohl, sitting in for Mark Bayshore today. Mark is on vacation this week, and let the record show that the first time there was a guest host on the program, it was me. Glad to be here, and thank you for joining us on Current State. Coming up on today's show, we'll look at state university enrollment trends with Bridge Magazine senior editor Ron French. We'll have a report about the East Lansing School District's effort to upgrade its technology. And the Detroit Free Press's Joe Rexroad will dissect MSU's loss at Ohio State. And MLive's Angela Wittrock will break down the Lansing metro area's real GDP. But first, the state Republican and Democratic parties held conventions this weekend, and news was made at both. After 18 years, Mark Brewer is out as leader of the Michigan Democratic Party, removing his name from consideration before the party's chairmanship could go up for a vote. Lon Johnson takes over. Meanwhile, Michigan Republican Party Chairman Bobby Shostak faced a challenge from Tea Party nominee Todd Corser. The Michigan Public Radio Network covered both conventions. Managing editor Rick Pluta is here to help us break down the story with the Democrats. And in a few minutes, we'll also talk with MPRN reporter Jake Neer about the Republicans. Good morning, Rick. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, glad to be here.
So what exactly went on at the Democratic Party convention? What led up to Lon Johnson's ascension?
Well, I mean, it's sort of interesting that you look at both parties, and even though both can claim their share of victories last November, there's really a lot of consternation over where they fell short. In the case of Republicans, it's that they weren't able to organize the state to win a presidential victory after, you know, five successive losses. This was the sixth time that Democrats have claimed Michigan and its electoral votes for the Democrat, even though Mitt Romney was born here. On the Democratic side, there's this frustration that you can organize the state so that President Obama wins it by 9 points, more than 9 points, actually. I mean, it was almost double digits, that you can sweep the bottom of the ticket races, the races for things like MSU trustee that are really largely a measure of baseline party strength, but then in the middle, you're just kind of helpless as you watch Republicans year after year take the attorney general, take the secretary of state, that you've never been able to take the state senate from Republicans since the early 1980s, that the House remains in Republican control, the upshot being that after, you know, in the lame duck of last year, that Michigan became or is about to become a right-to-work state. So these were the frustrations that were playing out at the Democratic convention, and it was both a proxy fight between unions, primarily the United Auto Workers, which really dominates the Democratic Party, arguing for change, and the Michigan Education Association arguing for a continuation of the current leadership and then hopefully, you know, adjusting to meet what was going on. And so what happened was basically the UAW won that fight, arguing for change, you know, even though they're the ones who've kind of been running the show all along. Mm.
Lon Johnson joins us on the phone. Mr. Johnson, thank you for joining us today. We're going to do some looking back, but I want to begin with you by looking forward. What are your first tasks?
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me on the show this morning. Well, we've got to remake our great party. We started that Saturday, and with the help of Mark, you know, who I wanted to say, you know, terrific things about. You know, he went out the way he always conducted himself, always working to bring our party together, and now. Now we're going to set about the task of remaking our party, and that started on Saturday.
What was wrong with the way that the Michigan Democrats were running with Mark Brewer's leadership, though? Why did you think he needed to be replaced?
Well, I think it was just a recognition by all sides, you know, by many sides of our party, that we need to really think about how we're going about the business of winning. You know, winning you know, elections are more than just an opportunity to win. They're an obligation. We've got, when we don't win, bad things happen for Michigan. And it was a recognition that, you know, look, enough is enough. You know, emergency manager, right to work, pension tax, education cuts. You know, these are real issues that when we don't win at the state level, the voters, you know, Michigan is impacted, and we need to start winning. And it's also a recognition that campaigns and political, the political fight is now a 365-day affair, and we've got to engage. No longer are we just going to sit and engage June through November. We need to start now. And we need to start very aggressively, because when we don't, bad things happen.
Mr. Chairman, this is Rick Pluta. How are you?
Hi, good morning, Rick.
Hi. I have a question for you. If you could just put on sort of your you know, campaign mechanic hat, and
sure.
You know that we've seen, you know, Democrats succeeding and Republicans failing in statewide elections for federal offices, but not for statewide offices. That, you know, right now Republicans control all of the statewide offices out of Lansing, while, you know, they keep sending people to Washington, you know, usually with double digit victories. What's that dynamic? What's at play there that in statewide races? And for federal offices, Democrats succeed, but in statewide races for state offices, Republicans succeed.
Well, we share the values. We share values with the Michigan voters, you know, and that's evidenced by the fact, like you said earlier, you know, President Obama won this state by 9 points without, you know, hardly, you know, being outspent probably 2-3-1, hardly, you know, never coming here during the campaign. And this was Romney's home state. So it's evidenced by the fact Senator Stabenow winning the state by 20 points. So where is that disconnect, right? Where is that disconnect in what we're seeing in the federal offices and federal ballots and the House, I'm sorry, in the state races? I believe that disconnect is, we've got to do a better job of messaging to voters. We've got to do a better job of bringing in the tools, and it's a mechanical one, in part. We've got to start earlier. You know, these federal campaigns start very early, and they bring to bear tools that we saw work with President Obama. They bring to bear very sophisticated political tools. We've got to bring those same tools here to our state-run campaign so that we can start competing and winning.
So it sounds like the short answer to that question is that these campaigns for federal offices are not run out of the state party?
Well, they're just better run. Let's just say that. You know, when you look at President Obama's campaign, you know, he did a phenomenal job of taking supporters and turning them into volunteers and turning them into contributors and turning them into fundraisers. And he did that because, you know, he brought the tools to bear that to make it easy, to make it meaningful. And when we have as much support as we have in Michigan for the issues that we care about, the values that we share, you know, shame on us for not working with voters and our constituency groups and moving them forward all in the same direction to fight for the values that we all share.
You know, now that you've actually had the keys to, you know, Hart Kennedy House in downtown Lansing for a full day now and had a chance to sort of look things over, have there been any surprises in your first 24 hours on the job?
Not at all. You know, not at all. You know, the fight that we had was a meaningful, you know, it was one that I think was meaningful for our party. It's one that we should have, and it's about the direction of 2014. How do we go about the business of winning? You know, versus, you know, this was not an ideological split in our party. This was just, how do we go about the business of winning? And it was a spirited campaign, but in the end, we came together, and now we're going about that. And I've been welcomed by the other side, if you will, and I'm going to welcome them.
The UAW and the MEA split, though, leading into the convention. Can they get along now moving forward?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I don't think there was any other, you know, the split, if you will, was just, you know, one side was with one candidate and the other was with me. And this is not, again, this was not an ideological split. You know, President Cook of the MEA is on the record saying that he would be happy with whoever, you know, ultimately came out of this process. And I'm going to take him as word. And I've worked, you know, extensively with the MEA, and I don't foresee, and nor have I had any thus far, any problems. We're setting about the business of winning right now.
Is there a role for Mark Brewer going forward?
Absolutely. You know, we've
what
got
is
a,
it?
That's a little bit more for him to determine than it is for me. I, you know, Mark brings a lot of strength to our party, and he's been a terrific asset. And you know, coming off this campaign that's been less than almost a day and a half now. He needs to I think take a break and come back and figure out where he wants to play that role. And I believe you're going to have a party that's welcoming to that.
Lon Johnson is the new chairman of the Michigan Democratic Party. Thank you for joining us on Current State this morning.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Nice talking with you. We want to move on to cover the Republican convention this weekend, too. Now, Jake Neer is here with us from the Michigan Public Radio Network. Going into the weekend, the Democrats were getting all of the attention because of this Johnson-Brewer face-off. Not much was being said about a leadership challenge at the Republican convention, but there was one. In fact, a pretty close race as Todd Corser came within 4 percentage points of claiming the chairmanship of the party. What went on there?
Well, first of all, hi, Scott.
Good to have you
with
us,
Jake. Very glad to be here. Todd Corser was a candidate that was favored by many self-professed Tea Partiers in the Republican Party. And you know, if there were any thoughts going into this convention that the Tea Party presence in the state GOP was waning, you know, you can forget that. Basically, the enthusiasm was palpable in the room. You could feel it. I mean, you know, he had people as Bobby Shostak was getting nominated for the chair position. People were marching around the room, you know, with Todd Corser signs, just very vocal. He came within 4 percentage points, 52% to 48% of, replacing Shostak as chair. And I think that says quite a bit, about the, I think that the Tea Party made a very, a big statement saying, you know, we're still here and the party has to recognize us.
You talked with Todd Corser about his reasons for this challenge and what his vision was for the party. What sorts of things did he have to say?
Well, he basically said of course, afterward, he said that, you know, this is a conversation and the party needs to come back together, but he's going to do everything that he can to keep that conversation going.
I would follow, you know, Andrew Breitbart, who said, you know, if you can't sell freedom, then you suck. And we need to do a better job at getting our message out and explaining freedom and liberty to people and conservatism. And I think the Democrats just do a much better job in so many areas. When people want to analyze why the Democrats won last time, they say it was this or that or the other. I would say it was all those things, and they did them better than we did them.
So what sorts of things did Bobby Shostak have to say after posting a victory to hang on to his job?
The latter part of what I just said that Corser said was, of course, his message as well, that the Republican Party needs to, you know, if there's any hard feelings, they need to get past that and move forward. And basically the goal at this point is just to get the party infrastructure in place to be Democrats in 2014.
In any hotly contested race, you're going to have people from all sides, you know, speaking out. But at the end of the day, people together came forward and said, we want to beat the Democrats. We want to keep this conservative agenda of Snyder and Kelly moving forward. We want to fight for things that are important to our party and continue to message that home, you know, day in and day out, so that people don't forget it. And we grow our party and we build our party through those efforts. And as a result, I think that we have unified. We've unified in a big way, and we've unified in a way that I think will happily sail us right to 14 with victory.
So do you think this close result changes his approach moving forward?
I think that the most important aspect of the chair position is just getting results. There were some people coming up to reporters afterwards saying, well, this certainly isn't a mandate. And in the chair position, it seems like the mandate is just at the end of the day to win elections.
Mm-hmm. And raise money and do the mechanical things that are necessary. What you just heard there was the winner, you know, doing that awkward kabuki dance of, you know, yeah, we had a big spirited fight, but it was in the family, but everything's fine. There's no hard feelings. I mean, you know, Lon Johnson had to do the same thing in Detroit this weekend. As a matter of fact, you know, once something like this is over, your first job isn't to, you know, you sweep the floors or start raising raising money or do any of those other things. It's you pick up the phone and you start making phone calls to your adversaries to start binding the wounds and healing and hoping that that happens as quickly as possible. You know, but what we saw in Lansing this weekend was just a continuation of really the same thing we've seen for the past couple of years, that if you like a great, you know, if you want a great unpredictable political show, go to a Michigan Democratic or a Michigan Republican Party convention, because they're just the Wild West. You don't know what's going to happen. A couple of years ago, remember, you know, the Tea Party almost denied Rick Snyder his choice for nominee of lieutenant governor. And like Jake said, they're just showing that they're not going away.
There's no unity, real unity, until we move forward in either party. Is there something to that? Nobody's got a claim on unity now.
Something, and maybe Rick can enlighten me a little bit here, since you've been around a little bit longer. But it seems to me that in the case of the Republican Party, something that I felt while I was there at the convention this weekend is this dynamic. They're getting used to it. It's something that's been there. They know, you know, it's not the first party convention that the Tea Party's made a big statement. And especially with Bobby Shostak getting back into the chair position, he's has experience with bringing the party back together.
Well, you know, this is a problem that any party faces, that a political party is a coalition of people of often disparate beliefs who've found enough common cause to come together. And it was sort of put to me this way, that there's always this tension between coalition and purity. You know, people who want to do this. And so to win, what you've got to do is go in the intra-party fight and fight as hard as you can for the person that you think is the best person. And then you go, and then if you lose that fight, you still have to go in November and fight every bit as hard for the person you think is the least worst.
I want to talk a little bit about other things that were discussed at the conventions. I know that at the Republican convention, there was a resolution supporting right-to-work legislation and also to no longer have a winner-take-all system for electoral college votes, right?
That's correct. And I think that took up, especially the electoral college vote, was really the, if there was any policy discussion, that was the big one. And it just, both of them overwhelmingly passed. Of course, right-to-work, very popular amongst Republicans. But, you know, with the electoral college issue, this is something that Republicans weren't won over by this last year when it came up the first time, or at least, you know, it came up last time, I should say.
Funny how losing can change your mind.
Exactly.
Anything else aside from the chairmanship at the Democratic convention that we can briefly touch on?
You know, I mean, that was the big show. And, you know, now what it is, it's, you know, what they're doing now going forward is, it's a little ironic, but now Democrats have to reach out to a lot of people who maybe are sympathizers but don't have a lot of ownership over the Democratic Party. You know, they've got to increase African-American turnout if they're going to change the results of elections at the state level, embrace LGBT, stuff like that. That's what they're doing, so that the unions are less dominant.
All right. Thank you very much, Rick Pluta, Jake Neer of the Michigan Public Radio Network, and earlier in the segment, Lon Johnson, the new chairman of the Michigan Democratic Party. Thanks for joining us on Current State.
Thanks, Scott.
For the first time all season, the MSU men's basketball team has lost two games in a row. After dropping a decision to first place Indiana last week, the number 4 Spartans fell to number 18 Ohio State in Columbus, 68-60 yesterday. Here to help us examine Spartan hoops and look ahead is Joe Rexroad, who covers Michigan State for the Detroit Free Press. Good talking with you, Joe. Good morning.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
Good. You?
I'm good. Yeah, it's, you know, it's... like you said, first two-game losing streak, and obviously, I mean, a week ago, this team was about a minute from being alone in first place in the Big Ten, and that's how fast things can change. Now, basically out of the race, still in it mathematically if Indiana, you know, loses a couple times, but for the most part, you know, Michigan State's playing for NCAA tournament seeding now.
Yeah, Indiana falling out of the top spot seems really unlikely now.
Yeah, I mean, Indiana plays at Minnesota tomorrow night, so, you know, there's a chance, but the way Minnesota is playing, the way Indiana's playing, you wouldn't think it'd be much of a chance. And of course, Indiana still has to go to Michigan on the last day of the regular season, so you know, slim chance. But of course, Michigan State would have to win out, and there are a lot of things to to fix for that to even be possible.
Well, let's look at yesterday's game. First of all, MSU looked pretty solid in the first half and for the first couple of minutes in the second half. But then Ohio State really turned the tables with a huge run. What happened there?
Yeah, it looked like Michigan State was in very good shape, up 9 early in the second half. Really had done a good job defensively, getting good shots. There was one play, Aaron Kraft missed a layup. He made many layups yesterday, but he missed one. The ball kind of got tapped out to Deshaun Thomas, the Big Ten's leading scorer, who had struggled all day. I think at that point it was 1-for-9, and he hit a three-pointer. And that seemed to be a really big play. But the big problem for Michigan State yesterday was that Aaron Kraft got by Keith Appling a lot and got to the rim a lot. And, you know, there were some team defense things in there, and Tom Izzo took the blame and said, you know, their defense against the ball screens was not good in terms of, you know, in terms of concept or execution for everyone. But, you know, a big thing was that Aaron Kraft just was aggressive and got by his man a lot, and that set up players for shots or got him inside. He had 7 layups yesterday.
Amazing. Now, Keith Appling has been struggling lately at point guard. He's not scoring much and having trouble at the defensive end of the floor. What's going on with Keith Appling?
Well, that's a great question. And you know, certainly he was asked that, and Tom Izzo at one point just said, look, I don't know. Banged up. Keith did acknowledge that, but not anything specific. So I think maybe, you know, more that he's tired, that he's fatigued, and that's understandable. I mean, he's played heavy minutes. He's had to lead this team in scoring, run the team, and usually guard the other team's best player. And with Travis Trice out for his backup, out for, you know, 4 games with the concussion-like symptoms, that put even more of a burden on Appling. So all those things add up, but still, it was, you know, somewhat stunning to see how he struggled in those 2 games last week when you look at how he's played for the rest of the season. So getting him back, getting his confidence back is, you know, the top priority for Michigan State right now.
How close do you think Travis Trice is to playing at 100%?
Well, I mean, I think in terms of health, he's there. They wouldn't have let him, you know. That, I think, you know, he maybe could have come back a little bit earlier, but, you know, they're going to make sure the head was totally clear, of course.
Sure.
Now, in terms of 100%, you know, getting in game shape, I think that's the big thing with him. When you miss that much time, you know, you lose your conditioning, and he wasn't really able to do a lot of conditioning for a lot of that stretch. So, you know, I'm sure it may take him a couple more weeks to really get to the point where he could play, you know, 20-plus minutes if Michigan State needed him to.
It sounds like the whole team could use this break that's coming up. No games for a full week until playing at Michigan next Sunday.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think in a way it'll be good for them, like you said, to get the rest. I think on the other hand, when you lose 2 games in a row, you want to get back out there as soon as possible and, you know, turn things around. But, you know, they'll have a lot of time to prepare, rest, and then obviously a huge game Sunday at Michigan.
One other thing we want to touch on with you is the NFL Combine was held over the weekend, and a few of the MSU players or former now players at Michigan State were there. What are you hearing about how the Spartans did at the Combine?
Yeah, and actually still going on. Will Golston just ran this morning, the 40, and according to reports out of Indianapolis, he ran a 4.93, which really isn't a great time for him. But Le'Veon Bell, I think, helped himself. He ran a 4.6. You know, the 40 times, 40-yard dash, you know, it may be overblown a little bit, but you know, obviously they're important, and teams care about that. So Le'Veon Bell running a 4.6 is pretty good for him to go with, you know, his size and his shiftiness. So I think he's helped himself. You know, Deion Sims ran a 4.75, which is average, not terribly surprising. He's, you know, the tight end, and he's a big, you know, strong guy, good hands who can block. So I would say if anyone helped himself so far, it would be Le'Veon Bell. Johnny Adams will run tomorrow, the cornerback. So I would say, I guess, if anyone, you know, most of those guys are projected kind of in the middle rounds, maybe Le'Veon Bell will move up out of this.
All right. Joe Rexroad of the Detroit Free Press, always good talking with you. Thanks for joining us on Current State.
Okay, thanks, Scott. Appreciate it.
Coming up after the break, we'll look at Bridge Magazine's breakdown of public university enrollment trends in Michigan. I'm Scott Pohl, and you're listening to Current State on WKAR. Good morning. Welcome back to Current State. I'm Scott Pohl, filling in today for Mark Bayshore on the program. We want to begin the next segment of the program with an update on a news story that lots of people have begun following from over the weekend here in the MSU community. A suspect is in custody this morning in connection with the apparent stabbing death of MSU senior Andrew Singler early Saturday morning. Singler was stabbed at a residence in Meridian Township and pronounced dead at Sparrow Hospital in Lansing. Police will meet with the Ingham County Prosecutor's Office today. Prosecutors could formally arraign the suspect later this afternoon. A new story from Bridge Magazine poses a provocative question for the parents of Michigan's high schoolers. Is a student from China taking my kid's college slot? The story explores recent trends in freshman enrollment at the state's public universities. A number of them have seen dramatic increases in the number of international and out-of-state students. Ron French compiled the story and joins us this morning on Current State. Hi, Ron. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
Good to have you with us on the program. I want to start out with a piece of tape that's a couple of years old now. Back in September of 2009, I did a story here on WKAR about the growing number of Chinese students at MSU. I started the story with a visit to that fall's big dinner where international students are invited to gather at the Breslin Center. The director of MSU's Office for International Students and Scholars, Peter Briggs, read off an alphabetical list of the nations, and it was a pretty sedate affair until he got to the C's.
Our neighbor to the north, Canada. Chile. Now, are you ready? China.
Listen to that roar of the crowd. Far more Chinese students than from any other countries, really actually from all of the other countries combined. Now, 5 years earlier, there had been 94 students here from China. That year, more than 1,800 Chinese students had enrolled at MSU. And again, that was 3 years ago. So where do things stand now?
Well, it's interesting. I think the audience will be a little louder in 2013 than they were in 2009. What I have in front of me here is data for the freshman class. So, right. So just looking at the freshman class, back in 2002, there were four Chinese freshmen.
Wow.
In the fall of 2012, there were 1,543. That's an increase of 385 times in a decade. And so it's obvious to anyone who's around East Lansing that this change is occurring, and so it raises some questions about why is it happening and what is the impact.
No, I understand one reason it raised a question in your mind is that you have two high schoolers yourself.
That's true. I do. So it was interesting to, we were going through the college application process ourselves, and we have a lot of friends who have children who are going through the process, and it's a very anxious time, and you run through all sorts of questions. Is my kid's GPA high enough? Did they score high enough on the ACT and SAT? And then when you see these numbers, you think, oh my goodness, is there some other factor involved? Because everyone knows that there's a concern about state funding for the public universities, and how are the public universities reacting to lower state funding? One way they might react is to bring in more students from out of state because they pay more tuition. And then from people all across the state, there are thousands of families out there waiting right now to get acceptances from University of Michigan or Michigan State. It's a very anxious time, and they're wondering, gosh, well, will they be accepting someone from St. Louis instead of from Langsburg?
Or Beijing.
That's why we started to look at this question.
Well, what exactly did you look into besides the raw numbers?
Well, we looked at the raw numbers, and then we also looked at the proportion of Michigan students in the incoming classes, because raw numbers can tell you one thing, but you also have to look at the size of the classes. The size of the classes have been growing. When you really dive down a little more in the numbers, you see that the number of Michigan students, incoming freshmen, at Michigan State, for example, where we are here today, and at University of Michigan, are holding fairly steady. Maybe at Michigan State have gone down a little, but not significantly. But when you look at it as a proportion of the incoming class, they're dropping pretty precipitously. In the past decade, the proportion of incoming freshmen at Michigan State that are from Michigan has dropped from 88% to 70%. And so, you know, that raised some issues. Was that a conscious decision on the university's part?
You know, there's a common perception that international and out-of-state students are crowding out in-state students. So are you suggesting that there's a lot of truth in that perception as a result of the numbers you just cited?
We went into it wanting to know that the answer to that question. And the short answer is no, they're not. Even despite those numbers, when you see the proportion of Michigan students going down, the main reason that is occurring, well, there's two things going on. One of them, though, the biggest one, is that there are fewer high school graduates coming out of Michigan. Michigan is shrinking. There are fewer kids graduating from high school, which is because there are fewer high school kids. When you look at the percentage of kids that are being accepted who apply to Michigan State, for example, in the past decade, it's actually gone up at Michigan State. There are more, that you have a higher percentage chance of getting into Michigan State applying today than you did a decade ago. And at University of Michigan, as another example, you think, well, gosh, what's happening there? Because, you know, they have people from all over the world there too. Well, among Michigan applicants, they accept 54% of them. And across the United States, they accept 31%. And internationally, they accept 12%. So your chances still are pretty darn good of getting into public universities here.
At Michigan State, anyway, the collective GPA of the incoming freshman class has been going up in recent years, too. Is that a factor, the GPA of the graduates that MSU is producing?
Well, that makes it tougher to get in. But then again, that's happening at almost every university in the country, every research university, at least. There are universities you can get into no matter what your GPA is, frankly, you know, and that's good because more and more jobs require some sort of college education. But when you talk about these research and highly selective universities like MSU and U of M, the GPA is going up, but the quality of the students is going up. So
tell me about the response that this article or slideshow on the Bridge website has been receiving.
It's received a lot of notice. I think a lot of parents are very interested in finding out what's this stuff, because there was a lot of concern out there. We felt it was sort of information was good to get out there because it sort of relieves some of those myths that are out there about how the universities pick their students.
The governor is calling for a slight increase in university funding from the state. Do you know what the likely impact of future increases on freshman enrollment trends might be?
I'm afraid I do not. And my speculation would be worthless at this point.
Okay. Now, what does this end up meaning for in-state families with kids who want to go to a state university?
If you have a high school student trying to get into a public university in Michigan, more than likely you can get into one. And the chances are pretty decent if you apply even at U of M or MSU that you can get in. And if you can't get in there by chance, there's a lot of other very good ones, Central, Northern, Western. A lot of these universities are very good and get a great education there.
Very interesting talking with you and an interesting story in the Bridge magazine. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Ron French is a senior writer for Bridge magazine. Check out his story, Is a Student from China Taking My Kid's College Slot, at bridgemi.com. Tomorrow, East Lansing voters will decide on a school bond issue to upgrade outdated equipment. The measure would raise more than $5 million for the upgrade. Current State's Kevin Lavery visits East Lansing High School to speak with the district's Director of Technology, Christian Palasti.
I think we have 1,200 to 1,500 PCs and laptops. Wireless nodes, a wireless node is an antenna that's in the ceiling or otherwise placed throughout the school. We don't have a really good inventory of those devices, but there are many. And when we're done, we're actually looking at placing one antenna per classroom. And I believe we have somewhere around 300 classrooms. The phones, somewhere near 400 probably. Lots of equipment.
So these pieces of equipment are outliving their usefulness and are being superseded by more current technology.
Yes. In particular, the computers that we have in the district, the oldest ones are 10 years of age. So a laptop that's 10 years old in the hands of a student is not nearly as productive as one that's a year old or something less than that. So we need to replace PCs so that we can get a little bit more use out of them and have them be more productive and not be in the position that they're in right now, which is impeding the instruction sometimes.
Aside from the physical age of some of this equipment, teachers use technology differently. Students learn via technology differently. So it's not just a matter of age, it's a matter of the style or the manner in which education is conducted today.
Yeah, that's one of the key things that we've talked about with this, and we're not in a position to support it for either group of people, be it teachers or students. And there's a very clear level of frustration on the teacher's part. When the technology doesn't work, the technology that is there isn't integrated very well, and they have four remotes for four different input devices. Students get frustrated and they lose documents or they can't connect to the internet adequately. And one of the antidotes that we've talked about when we go out is the students come in here, and we have Office 2000. And so they're using Microsoft Office 2000 to create documents here. When they go home, they may have Microsoft Office 2010. And they create documents that can't be opened here. So then we tell them to convert them, put them on Google Apps, and then they come in here and they don't have adequate bandwidth to get to Google to get the document back down. So I know that they're very frustrated in trying to convert their work to bring it in here. And so their learning is being impacted by this.
Okay, let's take a look what we're talking about.
All right, we'll step into this room here, which is the center of all the data and most other equipment for the district. This is the server room for the district, so a lot of what we're talking about replacing starts here. This is our voicemail system, and it operates on a very old DOS screen, as you can see. And we're looking at going to a voice over IP system, which is utilizing our current Ethernet network that we have.
And again, the infrastructure in this room is about how old?
Some of this is 20 years of age. These here are 15 to 19. That one's 20. This Ethernet equipment here, which manages the fixed computer network, so the PCs and the labs that plug in, they all come back to here. This equipment is 10 years old. It was put in with the last bond. It's outdated. We would be able to sell this off. There's still a market for this equipment, and it would go towards the replacement of this equipment.
We had Superintendent Dave Chapin on our show, actually our inaugural show, on January 14th. The Newtown, Connecticut shooting had been very fresh. It had happened just about a month earlier. This bond issue, this project, had been in the works for quite some time, even before some of these recent shootings happened, and he didn't want to peg the two together. But I'm wondering if that is in the minds of the district parents.
Well, the security was on the bond last year. We talked about the video surveillance and the exterior doors then, a year ago. With situations like Newtown and other things that have come up, it's forced us to pay a little bit more attention to it. And what may have taken place in year two or three, we've moved it up to year one. So it's been a present thought. It's obviously heightened in today's age, but definitely been there, definitely going to be addressed. This here is the security room for the high school. And what we have are banks of monitors that show all the camera angles for the cameras that are located throughout the building. And what we want to do is have video surveillance added to all the buildings in the district. We don't want to be up and down the hallways as we have here at the elementaries. We think that we would just target main areas like the main entrance, the parking lot, maybe the playground. And these are old technology DVR units or digital video recorders. And if you could look behind this rack, there are miles of cable. And we could replace all of this and update it and go to more of a digital recording system and more centrally manage the surveillance in these buildings.
You have several monitors here, and I'm looking at least two that have, it looks like, 16 very small surveillance screens. If something amiss were to happen on one of these panels, is there something automatic that alerts the people who need to know that there's something not right happening in a certain part of the building?
No, there's no way of doing that. If it's a real-time situation, if they saw it on camera, then that would enable them to take action, and we could then tie into the electronic door system if need be and do a lockdown, be able to tie into the PA phone system and issue an alert. If they don't see it on the cameras, then that's where we would hope somebody within the building would see it and be able to pick up a phone somewhere and issue an all call so that the threat could be taken care of and corralled as best as possible.
But that's the key. You have to see it and be aware of it in real time as it's happening and react to it.
Correct. And right now, if something happened in some area of the building, we have a lot of things in place right now No question that we have secure buildings, no question that people feel safe, but we have to respond to these and do the best that we can to make sure that people feel safe.
I'm struggling to think of a question that's relevant to what happened up in northern Michigan, the zombie alert hacking up in the Marquette area. Back on February 11th, two local public TV stations had their emergency alert systems hacked into with this bogus warning of a zombie attack. As far-fetched as that may have sounded, perhaps, certainly reality. So security of the security systems, I mean, is that something that's also on the district's mind?
Oh, very much. We have to make sure that these systems that we have in place are not widely advertised as far as how to gain access to them. Very similar to 5 years ago or even today, the knowledge that if you pick up the keyboard, there's the teacher's password, you know, to their account. Just type it in and you're now on the system. So it's anything that we put in, we have to educate the staff so that they know how to use it and also how to prevent somebody else from using it.
You and some other key people in the district, I'm sure, have been taking this message out to the community. What's the receptivity level like? Is there anyone who's voicing concerns over the adequacy of this bond, over the financing, any visible opposition or concern at this point?
I have not seen any opposition. The community members that have come to the meetings that we've been to have been very supportive. They understand the need. We explain to them what this is going to address. We explain that there are no frivolous items here. Everything has a very critical need and a placement, and it's for the safety and security of the students. They've been very supportive. The people that we have talked to have asked wonderful questions. We've explained it, and they walk away, I think, more knowledgeable and able to make a decision that works best for them.
That's Current State's Kevin Lavery with East Lansing School District Director of Technology, Christian Palasti. Every Monday morning here on Current State, we are happy to be joined by MLive Media Group reporter Angela Wittrock for a look at what's going on in the Lansing business community. Hi, Angela.
Hi, Scott. How are you?
Good. Good to have you back on the show today. Last Friday, you had a story about the real GDP in the Lansing, East Lansing metro area, looking at things like GDP increasing over the past few years. But once the dollar figures were adjusted for inflation, it turns out that the local economy actually contracted.
That's true, yeah. Looking back over the past 4 or 5 years, as the numbers from the Bureau of Labor federally found, it looks like dollar-wise, there was a tremendous amount of growth in the region. Of course, once you adjust those numbers for inflation, what we found is that the economy actually contracted locally by a factor of 0.52%. It's not a huge amount, but it's pretty notable when you consider that the majority of labor markets in the U.S. did actually experience growth, and Lansing region did not. And what we found actually was that the reason for that was led by a decrease in spending in the government sector. So you figure some of those jobs that were cut in 2010, et cetera, almost 1% of the GDP loss was due to that.
And we're talking about not just state government, but local government jobs too, right?
Right. Yeah. The entire government sector contracted quite a bit.
All right. Does that tell us anything about the future?
Well, I think what it says is that, you know, it's always been important for local economies to diversify. Places like Lansing that are heavily, we have the state capital here, heavily dependent on jobs that are state government related and state government proper. So what does need to happen is something that, you know, Mayor Virge Bernero and economic development agencies like LEAP have been really focused on is finding lots of ways to what they call grow the pie, so you're not dependent on any one industry that, you know, may or may not sustain you for very long.
One of the other stories you've been looking into is salaries of local school superintendents.
Yes. We have a story up this morning looking at how much school superintendents are making when you consider their salary and their entire compensation package. The story is based on a database put together by the Mackinac Center. They're a conservative think tank out of the Midland area. And what they determined was that Lansing School District's Superintendent Yvonne Kumul-Knall actually makes the 10th highest amount of money in the state when you factor in her retirement package, et cetera. That's pretty much on par with the amount of students in the area. We have the 12th highest enrollment statewide, but it is kind of a revelation when you see how much money goes into salary versus other things like retirement, healthcare, et cetera.
what were you able to discover about other local superintendents?
They're notable? Further down the list. East Lansing and Okemos make substantially less when you factor in the amount, the total compensation package. The salaries aren't tremendously different. I think the Lansing School District superintendent salary is around $140,000. That's kind of the average. It's the compensation that differs. And of course, Okemos and East Lansing have about a fourth the enrollment. So, you know, if you wanted to break it out per pupil, you're getting a lot more bang for your buck out of the Lansing School District than you are East Lansing.
Local gas prices have been spiking recently. I think getting close to $4 a gallon is something we've become a bit accustomed to in the summer months, but not in the winter. What do you know about that?
Well, the gas prices are thankfully down as of this morning. The state, or the average in Lansing, actually went down to $3.80 this morning, as opposed to $3.93 last week. So it seems like quite a break. It's a 13-cent drop, but it's still pretty painful. And the reason for that, I guess, is that we've seen a lot of refineries closing. They're either offline for maintenance or they're just closed because they can't make enough money. It's a pretty slim profit margin. So it's highly unusual to have prices this high in the dead of winter, but it looks like it could go on.
We're used to knowing about the transition to the summer formula for gasoline and that the price is always going to be a little more expensive in the summer. So being this high in the winter, does that bode ill for the summer prices we're expecting?
You would hope that, no. We expect some of these refineries to come back online, the ones that are down for maintenance, and perhaps some new refineries would be opening up. But otherwise, you know, it's a pretty volatile market right now for oil, so it could go either way.
Later this week, the Lansing Financial Health Team will be issuing its recommendations to Mayor Bernero. What are we hearing about that in advance of that report?
What we're hearing in advance is a whole lot of nothing. They're pretty close to the vest, pretty tight-lipped. I tried multiple times to buttonhole some of the folks on that team, and they all referred me back to no comment. But what we have heard tangentially is that they're recommending everything. It could be from privatizing services like parking, like trash, to expanding services like trash so that it's all publicly provided. So really what we're seeing are the possibility of recommendations that run the gamut. You know, I don't know if we'll see huge recommendations in adjusting retirement or healthcare benefits, but you can bet those will probably be on the table. The extent to which the Bernero administration will adopt them in the coming budget is really the big question.
How soon will we know what's in that report? Right away, or does the mayor have some time to consider its contents before we hear more about it?
David Hollister, who's the chair of that team, did say that he will give the report to Mayor Bernero hopefully around the 1st of March. That does not mean that we in the media will get it or that the city council will get it. We're hoping to find a way to kind of force their hand a little bit so we can get a look at it, but it could be that we don't see it at all. Or that we don't see it until after the budget's been nailed down.
One last real quick question. Does having former Mayor Hollister chair that panel add any weight to its contents?
I think it does. I think we see that Mayor Bernero is very comfortable with Hollister and with his recommendations. And, you know, he is sort of the elder statesman of the city.
All right. Always good talking with you. Angela Wittrock, a reporter with the MLive Media Group. Thanks for joining us this morning.
My pleasure, Scott.
And you're going to be in this chair on Thursday, right?
I will. I'll be in the hot seat.
Excellent. It's my place today, yours Thursday.
That's right. Put my name there.
Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
It's been a pleasure to keep the seat warm for Mark Bayshore while he's on vacation today. Tomorrow, it's current state executive producer Peter Worf's turn in the chair. Joe Lindstroth is the producer of the show. Thanks to Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Scott Pohl, and you've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by Fluke Hearing, finding ways to help people hear like nature intended, with 16 locations including Lansing, Jackson, Grand Rapids, and Ann Arbor. FlukeHearing.com.